Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace for your double dose for the day. It's the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. I hope you liked the Dear Uncle Leo episode. I'll do another one soon enough, so if you want some questions answered, pop them through to me. You can find me, I'm sure. This is Book 10, Chapter 18. When Pierre returned home, he was handed two of Rostopchin's broadsheets that had been brought that day. The first declared that the report that Count Rostopchin had forbidden people to leave Moscow was false. On the contrary, he was glad that ladies and tradesmen's wives were leaving the city. "There will be less panic and less gossip," ran the broadsheet, "but I will stake my life on it that that scoundrel will not enter Moscow." These words showed Pierre clearly for the first time that the French would enter Moscow. The second broadsheet stated that our headquarters were at Vyazma, that Count Wittgenstein had defeated the French, but that as many of the inhabitants of Moscow wished to be armed, weapons were ready for them at the arsenal, sabres, pistols, and muskets, which could be had at a low price. The tone of this proclamation was not a jocose as in the former Chigurin talks. Pierre pondered over these broadsheets, evidently the terrible storm cloud he had desired with the whole strength of his soul, but which yet aroused involuntary horror in him, was drawing near. "Shall I join the army and enter the service or wait?" he asked himself for the 100th time. He took a pack of cards that lay on the table and began to lay them out for a game of patience. "If this patience comes out," he said to himself after shuffling the cards, holding them in his hand and lifting his head, "if it comes out, it means... what does it mean?" He had not decided what it should mean when he heard the voice of the eldest princess at the door asking whether she might come in. "Then it will mean that I must go to the army," said Pierre to himself. "Come in, come in," he added to the princess. Only the eldest princess, the one with the stony face and a long waist, was still living in Pierre's house. The two younger ones had both married. "Excuse my coming to you, cousin," she said in a reproachful and agitated voice. "You know some decision must be come to. What is going to happen? Everyone has left Moscow and the people are rioting. How is it that we are staying on?" "On the contrary, things seem satisfactory, ma cousine," said Pierre in the bantering tone he habitually adopted towards her, always feeling uncomfortable in the role of her benefactor. "Satisfactory indeed, very satisfactory. Barbara Ivanovna told me today how our troops are distinguishing themselves. It certainly does them credit. And the people, too, are quite mutinous. They no longer obey. Even my maid has taken to being rude. At this rate, they will soon begin beating us. One can't walk in the streets. But above all, the French will be here any day now, so what are we waiting for? I ask just one thing of you, cousin," she went on. "Arrange for me to be taken to Petersburg. Whatever I may be, I can't live under Bonaparte's rule." "Oh, come, ma cousine. Where do you get your information from? On the contrary, I won't submit to your Napoleon. Others may, if they please, if you don't want to do this. But I will. I'll give the order at once." The princess was apparently vexed at not having anyone to be angry with. Muttering to herself, she sat down on a chair. "But you have been misinformed," said Pierre. "Everything is quiet in the city, and there is not the slightest danger. See? I've just been reading." He showed her the broadsheet. "Count Rostopchin writes that he will stake his life on it that the enemy will not enter Moscow." "Oh, that count of yours," said the princess malevolently. "He is a hypocrite, a rascal, who has himself roused the people to riot. Didn't he write in those idiotic broadsheets that anyone, whoever it might be, should be dragged to the lockup by his hair? How silly. And honour and glory to whoever captures him, he says. This is what his cajolery has brought us to. Barbara Ivanovna told me the mob nearly killed her because she said something in French." Oh, but it's so... You take everything to heart, said Pierre, and began laying out his cards for patience. Although that patience did come out, Pierre did not join the army, but remained in deserted Moscow, ever in the same state of agitation, irresolution, and alarm, yet at the same time joyfully expecting something terrible. Next day, towards evening, the princess set off, and Pierre's head steward came to inform him that the money needed for the equipment of his regiment could not be found without selling one of the estates. In general, the head steward made out to Pierre that his project of raising a regiment would ruin him. Pierre listened to him, scarcely able to repress a smile. "Well then, sell it," said he. "What's to be done? I can't draw back now." The worse everything became, especially his own affairs, the better was Pierre pleased, and the more evident was it that the catastrophe he expected was approaching. Hardly anyone he knew was left in town. Julie had gone, and so had Princess Mary. Of his intimate friends, only the Rostovs remained, but he did not go to see them. To distract his thoughts, he drove, that day, to the village of Vorontsovo, to see the great balloon Lepik was constructing to destroy the foe, and a trial balloon that was to go up next day. The balloon was not yet ready, but Pierre learnt that it was being constructed by the Emperor's desire. The Emperor had written to Count Rostopchin as follows: "As soon as Lepchin is ready, get together a crew of reliable and intelligent men for his car, and send a courier to General Kutuzov to let him know. I have informed him of the matter. Please impress upon Lepchin to be very careful where he descends for the first time, that he may not make a mistake and fall into enemy's hands. It is essential for him to combine his movements with those of the commander-in-chief." On his way home from Vorontsovo, as he was passing the Bolotnoy place, Pierre, seeing a large crowd around the Lobno place, stopped and got out of his trap. The footnote says the place of execution in Moscow, formerly situated on the Red Square, facing the Kremlin, but before 1812 it had been removed to another part of the town. A French cook accused of being a spy was being flogged. The flogging was only just over, and the executioner was releasing from the flogging bench a stout man with red whiskers, in blue stockings and a green jacket, who was moaning piteously. Another criminal, thin and pale, stood near. Judging by their faces, they were both Frenchmen. With a frightened and suffering look resembling that on the thin Frenchman's face, Pierre pushed his way in through the crowd. "What is it? Who is it? What is it for?" he kept asking. But the attention of the crowd, officials, burghers, shopkeepers, peasants, and women in cloaks and in pelisses, was so eagerly centred on what was passing in Lobno Place that no one answered him. The stout man rose, frowned, shrugged his shoulders, and evidently, trying to appear firm, began to pull his jacket without looking about him. But suddenly his lips trembled and he began to cry in the way full-blooded grown-up men cry, though angry with himself for doing so. In the crowd, people began talking loudly to stifle their feelings of pity, as it seemed to Pierre. "He's cook to some prince. Eh, monsieur, Russian sauce seems to be sour to a Frenchman. Sets his teeth on edge," said a wrinkled clerk who was standing behind Pierre, when the Frenchman began to cry. The clerk glanced round, evidently hoping that his joke would be appreciated. Some people began to laugh, others continued to watch in dismay the executioner who was undressing the other man. Pierre choked, his face puckered, and he turned hastily away, went back to his trap, muttering something to himself as he went, and took his seat. As they drove along, he shuddered, and exclaimed several times, so audibly that the coachman asked him, "What is your pleasure?" "Where are you going?" shouted Pierre to the man who was driving to Lubyanka Street. "To the governor's, as you ordered," answered the coachman. "Fool, idiot!" shouted Pierre, abusing his coachman, a thing he rarely did. "Home, I told you, and drive faster, blockhead. I must get away this very day," he murmured to himself. At the sight of the tortured Frenchman and the crowd surrounding the Lobno place, Pierre had so definitely made up his mind that he could no longer remain in Moscow, and would love to leave for the army that very day, that it seemed to him that either he had told the coachman this, or that the man ought to have known it of himself. On reaching home, Pierre gave orders to Evstafey, his head coachman, who knew everything, could do anything, and was known to all Moscow, that he would leave that night for the army at Mozyaysk, and that his saddle horses should be sent there. This could not all be arranged that day, so on Evstafey's representation, Pierre had to put off his departure till next day to allow time for the relay horses to be sent on in advance. On the 24th, the weather cleared up after a spell of rain, and after dinner Pierre left Moscow. When changing horses that night in Perkhuskovo, he learned that there had been a great battle that evening. This was the Battle of Shevardino. He was told that there in Perkhuskovo, the earth had trembled from the firing, but nobody could answer his questions as to who had won. At dawn next day, Pierre was approaching Mozyaysk. Every house in Mozyaysk had soldiers quartered in it, and at the hostel where Pierre was met by his groom and coachman, there was no room to be had. It was full of officers. Everywhere in Mozyaysk and beyond it, troops were stationed and on the march. Cossacks, foot and horse soldiers, wagons, caissons, and cannon were everywhere. Pierre pushed forward as fast as he could, and the farther he left Moscow behind, and the deeper he plunged into that sea of troops, the more was he overcome by a restless agitation and a new and joyful feeling he had not experienced before. It was a feeling akin to what he had felt at the Sloboda Palace during the Emperor's visit, a sense of necessity of undertaking something and sacrificing something. He now experienced a glad consciousness that everything that constitutes men's happiness, the comforts of life, wealth, even life itself, is rubbish. It is pleasant to throw away. Compared with something. With what? Pierre could not say, and he did not try to determine for whom and for what he felt such particular delight in sacrificing everything. He was not occupied with the question of what to sacrifice for. The fact of sacrificing in itself afforded him a new and joyous sensation. All right, there we go, another chapter down, and Pierre is being his indecisive self, not sure what he wants to do. He's trying to convince everyone that it's perfectly safe in Moscow, but it seems like he can't decide if he wants to stay there or not. I really like that scene where he played a game of patience, and he said, if I get patience, I'll join the army. And then he does get patience, and he goes, nah. Changed my mind. Not going to do it. Reddit user Laura Astrid said, "My copy has some great footnotes with extra info. It said Tolstoy often played himself a game of patience to decide things, as Pierre was doing to decide on leaving for war. Patience is solitaire." And like Pierre, he would ignore the results if he didn't like them. He was trying to decide if he'd write an article he had planned. The patience did not come out, but he got up and said, all the same, I shall write it. De Fleury said, "I'm embarrassed to say that Tolstoy / Pierre is me." You know, when I read that, that scene, I thought maybe he feels like he should join the army, you know, but he doesn't want to. That was what it seemed like. Like, why would he be saying, okay, if I get this unlikely turn of cards, I'll join the army, if he didn't want to, but thought that he should? That's how I read that. And then I thought, Pierre's the kind of guy that will always do what he thinks is right, eventually. And that illustrates to me that he thinks the right thing to do is to leave for war. So I'm a little bit worried that he's going to have this, like, conscience attack, which will make him go off to war. Reddit user Techrific says, "Well, hear, hear, I share that sentiment. I stumbled upon this sub as I'm currently reading War and Peace. I went looking for fellow readers. What can I say? It's an incredible book. His insight into human nature is astonishing, and all the characters are interesting, but Pierre intrigues me the most. His earnestness and confusion feels familiar. It feels like he's trying to hatch an egg, but he can't seem to muster what it takes to release himself from his own insecurities and rise to the full height of his potential." Well, Techrific, hello, welcome to A Year of War and Peace. Thank you very much for joining us, and hey, welcome to the podcast too. Who Was Once Delight said, "Welcome to the sub, glad you found us." JMama8779 said, "Is no one going to mention the French cook and the crying?" 100157 said, "Pretty interesting. Also interesting to see the society folk checking themselves against speaking French and using Gallicisms. I wonder about other examples where the leading lights are all obsessed with a foreign culture, but then the nation goes to war against the same. Was the American Revolution like this with England?" Who Was Once Delight responded, "Not sure how accurate this is, but a lot of the materials that we use to teach US history to fifth graders mentions random British sailors and etc. being treated pretty badly, similar to what was happening to the French cook by American revolutionaries in the colonies. Again, this is not hardcore scholarship. I'm talking episodes of Liberty Kids and the like. Moscow in this chapter just seemed like an alien landscape. I mean, more than it usually does to my modern American sensibilities." By the way, that word Gallicisms means a French expression, especially one adopted by speakers of another language. Man, what a specific word. I did not know that word. I just looked it up, and sometimes it's amazing the specificity of the English language. Now, finally, during reading this chapter, I had the realization that hot air balloons existed before aeroplanes. I always think of aeroplanes as the earliest human flight, but hot air balloons were up there first. Who Was Once Delight posted a link to an article about the hot air balloon that Pierre saw as he rode through Moscow in this chapter. So I will put a link to that same article in the description for this episode, if you can have a look there. Here's a little extract. Even by today's standards, Konstantin Tsiolkovsky's airship design was ambitious. 200 meters long, it would be propelled at 25 miles per hour by 8 steam engines and would carry 200 people and 14 tons of cargo. That is insane. For the early 1800s. That's incredible. It also says, making its first inauspicious appearance during the War of 1812 against Napoleon, the airship was later to serve as a vital step in the development of Russian air power, proving invaluable as a bombing craft in World War I. And today, the airship could be witnessing a minor renaissance. Okay. At the very end of that sentence, that paragraph, I realized that the airship isn't referring to a specific airship, it's referring to the thing of airships. For a second I thought that an airship that fought against Napoleon was used again 100 years later in World War I. It just meant airships were used. Still, pretty cool. Alright, that's going to do us for today. Thank you very much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.